sense of what you should be doing, mm-hmm. what you want to be doing, and how you would document a scholarly project like this, a digital humanities project. You know, again, that's kind of actually being looked at right now by Katrina Fenland. And that will be something that, you know, they're gonna have a data model for what you should be retaining, and, mm-hmm. you know, so there will be guidance on that, hopefully, soon.
As far as things like, oh, I'm sorry.
No, I was just saying, it's an important question that people are all asking, so.
As far as, like, how much do you need to preserve to make sure that your data is reproducible 20 years from now? I mean, document, right?
Mm-hmm.
As you go through everything you're doing, make sure you're documenting it. Make sure you're saving versions, like you're doing version control. But when it comes to, well, we used our studio version 6, and then 20 years down the road, they're on our, you know, studio 13 or whatever. I'm not aware of anyone taking that level of, and it'd be good if you can do it, but as a grant, oh, they are.
I'd say that data is less problematic than visualization, at least from my experience. Because we had this huge set of visualization, it was 12, and we finished it, I think it was the last one, 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And the bank used Code Fusion, that was for security reasons, and they changed the technology, and now it's completely out. It's not working, so this is saddest.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
I think you have to understand too, like the data should be permanent.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
But the interface stuff, the visualizations, unless you take a video of one, or you know things like that, those are more permanent because you can retain those over time. But a lot of the Fusion and all these other kind of technologies that are used to make visualizations may not be. Around depends on who made the tool, how sustainable that tool is. You know, I was looking, you know, some of the visualization tools, I was like, this is created by a university, who's going to keep that going?
That's always my biggest thing when it comes to the open source tools is what
is
the community behind the tool like? Is it something awesome like Zotero, where man, that community is super well established?
Yeah.
Or is it like DSpace, which is actually well established, just.
But even archiving a VM as your environment, who's to say that that VM would spin up 20 years from now?
Well, and who's
to, I mean,
does
like,
it
that
need
seems
to?
Be, that always seems to be the solution, is just package it as a VM with everything that ran so someone could reconstitute it, but there's no guarantee that that VM would even, I mean, if we start building quantum computers, right, I mean, binary information becomes
cost problematic.
I mean, so like, there's a certain level at which I guess what I'm pushing at is what is absolutely essential that exists for posterity from the project. And I think it's universally agreeable that the original data set, the annotated data set, and some version of the end product, which is kind of analogous to a lot of what would be in a traditional monograph, right? The source materials, to the extent that they were used to craft the historical argument, pointers to where those things were. If those archives exist still because of, you know, environmental archaeological change, I don't know, but at least you made the attempt to preserve it. And then the argument and the conclusions that were drawn from them. But it does seem to be get trickier when we start thinking about making it not just possible, but perhaps facile to spin up and redo everything that was done to create the final product 10, 20, 30 years from now.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of, again, a cost-risk analysis and, you know, benefit, because is someone going to want to reproduce exactly what you reproduced, or can they look at the products that you kind of documented and say, oh, well, this was a cool thing, maybe I can do something different. I mean, it costs to preserve data.
Yeah.
You know, and I think as more and more faculty begin to contribute to these data repositories and you know, preservation repositories, especially because those are actually not just a repository, they're actually services on top of the data and the content. So, you know, it does cost for us to put data in our repository is $600 per terabyte per year. It doesn't sound like a lot, but we have 62 terabytes right now. And that's just bankrupt, you know. So, I mean, it's, you know, if you think about the whole campus, it's going to start getting really rather significant.
As opposed to preserving the original data, annotation of the data, and explanation of the data, and perhaps a select sampling of whatever interactive interface boiled down to something that is preservable,
mm-hmm.
and limiting it to that.
Yeah. And the only other option would be to do HTML as your interface, which is kind of unsatisfying. So
yeah,
don't
not,
do that.
Yeah.
You know, but that's one of the, you know, it's like, oh, that's easy to preserve, but it's also not very satisfying.
I mean, you can preserve it as an output. You can have, like, your production environment somewhere. Like, you use something that generates the
but
HTML.
But on the, I guess on the other end of the spectrum, is that useful to someone?
What's that?
The stored and like boiled down HTML product of the thing that once was interactive. I mean, is it necessary for all of posterity to have access to, like, so?
What do you mean once interactive? Like, are we saying like HTML with no CSS or JavaScript? Like, what do you?
I mean, if you get into JavaScript, then you start getting into obsolescence as soon as you start getting into JavaScript.
So it would need to be HTML and CSS only output?
CSS is versioned? So, I mean, even now that, I mean, it,
it's
right?
Just
HTML
like
is versioned.
Yeah, just.
I mean, so it's, I mean, one of the big conversations in DH and is precisely this idea that if we could preserve all of it and then someone could remake it. But I don't know if that's necessarily focusing on the objective or the beneficial use case of having that level of preservation of.
I mean, I think if a future scholar wanted to see what you had done, you want to have enough that they could look back and say, "Oh, that's what they came up with. That was their conclusion.
Right.
And here's what they built it on, and here's how they built it." Then that scholar can take that data set and take it to the next tool, you know, the next system, and do their own analysis and come to their own conclusions and, you know, whatever it might be. But it seems like you just want to leave enough there.
But that seems to me the use case, or the, considering that use case, you wouldn't put something in like BinderHelp or Docker. You would document what tools you use, the process by which you came to your conclusion, the set and the conclusion.
What about ridiculously detailed annotation of HTML? Like if the documentation was replicated in the HTML?
This goes back to our conversation yesterday about TEI, though, is that there's a level at which TEI becomes so well documented that
yeah,
it makes the transition from intelligible to unintelligible.
Yeah, but that's the, like, with TEI, like, I haven't used it, but my understanding from the conversation was that it's not very human readable, whereas, like, comments, like, I'm thinking about our annotation as basically tutorials in the code for our teaching ethical data visualization.
Well, and I don't know too, like we were talking about Jupyter Notebooks being able to reproduce a visualization, and I don't know how sustainable that is, but I know that people are taking Jupyter Notebooks as part of their archive.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's a solution because I'm not sure how sustainable that is.
But it's also, I think there's what's going on in part is an interesting convergence of practices in the sciences with the humanities, because the humanities focus is preserving for the long haul. The sciences interest is reproducibility in the much more near term to figure out, can I redo this? Was it right? Can I redo it enough times to say it's right every time? Let's move on to the next problem. So like in the medical sciences, they're not archiving the specific fMRI machine that they were using to carry out a study. They're describing in a paper, they're documenting their process. But it seems like the conversation in the digital humanities is actually somehow bundling the fMRI machine with the data set and the process.
Yeah.
Well, there are, I mean, like all these emulation projects, like the one at Stanford to create emulation environments for historical software,
yeah.
right? So there is a lot of funding going into making sure that that's possible down the line for, right? So it's not that you're making it possible for something that was written for RStudio 6 that it will work, in, right? It's that it'll be possible to run RStudio 6 20 years from now.
And
that is like, that's all that you have to be able to preserve.
You can do emulation, but it's going to cost money. You're going to need to find an archive or a library willing to work with you that's going to be willing. Or if you want to try and do it yourself, you can.
Right.
I mean, I would probably recommend letting someone else handle it, to be honest. But then they're going to need resources to make sure that they can do that for the long term. And so...
But it's a very different goal. I mean, the emulating something like that is so that you can load up a piece of software from the 70s and rerun it and see what it looked like how as it used to run on a Commodore, right? And whereas emulating a software environment, if it's a matter of preserving it so that it could later be emulated if someone wanted to look at the visualizations that were created and interact with them in at least a proximate fashion, that's one thing. But if it's to keep it so that someone could then double check the veracity of it, that almost seems like a mapping of a much more short-term goal-oriented aspect of the sciences into an inapplicable humanities domain.
Well, and I think too, that's why, you know, we were talking about there's sometimes a time limit on some of these projects.
Yeah.
Like it's like we'll commit to keeping this up and running for 5 years.
Yeah.
If it's more less complex, maybe 10. But you know, I have projects where I have to tell the PIs, it's like, okay, we're killing this.
Yeah.
Do you want a web archive? Do you want a video? What do you want to do with this? So we can record it as a dynamic thing.
Yeah.
But we're recording it in a very kind of semi-static way because we just can't maintain it. And we're talking, I probably have at least 20, you know, digital humanities projects from the 90s and 2000s
yeah.
that people want us to preserve. And they're scholarly publications, so I think about them that way. I think it's like, okay, this was by a faculty member, and it's compelling and interesting, and we have none of the data, actually, for some of them, because they were so early, but, you know, we keep them going. I mean, we have the files that were, but we don't have, like, underlying data in some of it.
But the problem is when you start butting up against, say, like, corpus linguistics, you start running up against the edges of quote-unquote objective science with truth claims, and a lot of, like, the idea of preserving and reproducibility is someone else coming along and verifying the truthfulness of the claim that you made based off of the process you carried out, and so on and so forth. And like a lot of the conversations about, say, why you would use R, why would you put it in a Jupyter notebook, why would you share that, is so that you could demonstrate to someone else that you haven't, you know, waved your hands over here and secretly done something over here. And I'm wondering, though, that if, I mean, one part of me says that is a concern with the humanities because there is so much tomfoolery one could do. But at the same time, is it a problem that's now big enough that would justify the kind of preserving of the whole? Like, I don't know. Is someone going to come along? I mean, there's still fundamentally the subjective and interpretive nature of whatever I'm doing, even if it is in the trappings of this corpus linguistical model, that even preserving the way I did it with the environment and everything, you're never gonna get the humanities scholar reading the sources out of it to get it to this kind of capital T truth space. And so that I think, the reason why I bring it up, because that ends up shaping what it is that we actually then spend our efforts to preserve for the long haul from the project itself.
Yeah, and I think, you know, again, it's like that final analysis, the presentation of your final analysis. You know, if you kind of divorce, I mean, all of that you're going to put into that,
mm-hmm.
all that creates that, all that that's built on, should be in the data in the annotations, in the documentation somewhere, right?
Yeah.
So in a way, that's all still there. It just might take someone harder, you know, a longer time to put it all together, and you know, in terms of understanding your analysis.
Which is the level I'm more comfortable on, right? Because
yeah.
if a historian who went to the archive wrote an argument didn't destroy the archive, so I go back to the archive 30 years later and I go, I don't see what they saw.
Mm-hmm.
So if I preserve the data and I make my interpretation, if anyone looks at it 30 years from now, someone go back to the data and go, this, do they need to be using the exact same technique I use to come up with my interpretation to argue with me? Whereas in the sciences, it seems like on some level that is essential.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're trying to establish a natural law, you want to do the same thing every way, same time, okay, that's reproducible. Now let me change a few variables, see if it still holds true. Let me keep doing that until I say, this seems to hold true regardless, you know, this particular aspect, regardless of how I run it. That seems like a, I don't see that really applicable to a humanities interpretation of sources, regardless of the scientific methods that were used in the service of crafting the interpretation.
Well, let me, I just want to say, from a historical context, none of the funding agencies ever required any humanists to store and retain and preserve their stuff until kind of the last 10 years or so. And, you know, it's becoming more and more that they want to try to align it so that they, you know, that there is a product that comes out of this work. And it's not just an intellectual product, but there are, you know, they, you want to have something digitized and, you know. And
again, I think this is very similar to, you get your data, all the different formats of the docketed, your journal. Then you get the results of that analysis in your articles and your,
mm-hmm.
and you get two discussions out of this. You get the ethical discussion, why your results are applicable and why your results are valid for a particular perspective, including this discussion. And you get the technological discussion, why you try to preserve it in a different way. If you write both of them down in 2020,
yeah.
in 15 years' time, it will be absolutely fascinating to have. I wish I had a document like those two from 2005 and from 1990.
Yeah.
They want to have an ethical discussion about preserving, about analyzing a data set from 1990. I don't think I can find anything there. So if you get to, you have your data, you've got your ethical discussion, you've got the technological discussion, including all your data standards and everything else you stick with,
mm-hmm.
that will be absolutely fascinating to have in 15 years' time, regardless if your software still works or not.
Yeah.
Because it will not work. If you press the boundaries a little bit further for 50 years or 70 years, well, guaranteed it's not going to work.
And this is why I'm interested in your project and willing to sit here and talk with you, because I have an interest in this as well, because I find, you know, there's a benefit to us to figure this out.
Yeah.
You know, to try and figure out how we can work with scholars to figure this out. And what's important to the scholarly record that needs to be retained in projects like this? What is so important that what can we not lose, you know, in that end product that we want to carry forward? So that's my cost, my benefit to being part of the project. Because I think this is a really big problem. It's been, I mean, we've been talking about this at conferences, like, you know, how do we preserve scholarly digital humanities projects? And it's, yeah, I think it's a pretty timely thing. And if you start to kind of lay out how these decisions were made and what were the considerations, it will be really helpful to everyone who's trying to figure this out.
I also think that's a much smaller preservation footprint, though, of what needs to be saved, like in terms of technical infrastructure, than the full digital object and the means by which it was created. I mean, if that gets preserved, that's, if, but there's also kind of, but then there's the emulation work. So like, you preserve the code as it exists. Okay, that gets saved. 50 years from now, somebody builds an emulator of a 2020 machine running similar emulated hardware, boots it up, tries to run it. I mean, that's essentially the model we've been operating on. I mean, you can run software going back into the 70s and 80s on emulated machines without having kind of a prepackaged machine from then. I don't know. Katie looks like...
I'm just thinking about the reason why it's important to preserve the code in a way that it, when you run it, gives you exactly the same output that you got, which you then analyze. Because essentially what you're doing is you're creating another archive.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't save the code in a way that produces the same archive that you write the same output slash archive that you then analyzed to, and used to make visualizations, etc., write books, then you are like doing the same thing as the historian who doesn't have footnotes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's it's different, right? This is a different way of being a historian, and it's another layer of tracking and establishing trust with our peers that is worth a medium term preservation. I think there are certain time frames for preservation will be different for the different outputs of your project. I don't think they should all like be for 100 years, or even 50 years, or even 20 years. But I think in the short term of like people, short to medium term of people who are going to want to trace your
mm-hmm.
work in the same way that we, you know, shuffle through footnotes, that is important.
I think though it's also, I mean, I think part of the problem is time scale too. Like the likelihood in the sciences that someone will come along and challenge your work within 5 years, reproducing what you did and then tweaking it and arguing with it, is much higher than someone coming along and doing it within the short shelf life that would sustain how you did it.
Yeah.
And I don't think we have a habit of practice. Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think that in an ideal setting, you would preserve it so that someone can see what you saw and see how you got there and then be able to fully criticize not just what your interpretation was, but the method by which you obtained your interpretation so that we could produce better methods. I mean, that's one of the most interesting research areas isn't just, you know, the French imperial imagination, but also the process by which we get to an examination of such a thing. And so I think that's where that kind of middle interstitial thing is really, really interesting and important. But is it shouting into an empty room? Like spending all of this time on this thing that will have a short shelf life that someone won't come back to before it no longer works and would need to be reconstructed anyway, that one could do with just a copy of the code?
Well, but I think that saving a binder hub is, for example, not, takes 20 more minutes than just saving
right.
the code. I don't think that's a big burden, and putting that in a repository.
But the expectation that you would preserve that virtual environment, like putting it in binder hub, we know it'll be for the near term, accessible, but we don't know, like this kind of idea that would be still exist 50 years from now.
Well, yeah, but we didn't think we could, you know, access Lotus 1-2-3 files at this point in time, and we have emulators that let us do that now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so the technology is expanding too, so there might, you know, they might come up with a way how to just put all these things into a little bubble and we carry them forward, and you know, who knows. It's not been easy to do in the recent past, but considering all of the money and effort that's going into these projects now and the resources that are being created, I think there's going to be a lot more attention paid to how we preserve them carrying forward and what's important to keep. It's, you know, like I said, it's a big topic right now. So you're right on the edge of it.
And there will, like, it seems inevitable that there will be a backlash to the, to quote another one of Jeremy Crampton's articles that we haven't looked at here, collect it all, like the NSA.
Yes.
So good, like, mantra or slogan, like that we've adopted that wholesale in for fear of not wanting to miss out in the future. But you know, with the GDPR compliance issues in the EU, I'm starting to see startups voluntarily recording far less of like their user interaction data and just like trying to mitigate their risk that way. And I see maybe there's a potential, like there'll be a parallel for these reasons of what's the most ethical use of our data storage. And so maybe it's these skeleton things that allow us to reconstruct in an emulator and not the bulk that is, doesn't, what it does doesn't justify its space on a institutional wide.
There's also the layer at which preserving it in a virtual environment allows you to, so if it, as it's living and breathing on a server and exists for a long period of time, at some point it's going to break. At some point, you know, whatever modules running this, that, or the other aspect of it, they're going to make a major version jump from branch 2 to branch 3, you're completely changing the underlying architecture and everything you built isn't going to work anymore. So one of the benefits of having it preserved in the way it existed when you felt finished with the product is at least you've given some tool for future someone to, whatever work it would take, rebuild what you had at that moment and at least revitalize it. But I do think, you know, to kind of read the contrary point, I do think that there is a degree of kind of fear of missing out. That like, if we don't have it all, then something will be lost.
But
I think that is the kind of, I think that is the humanities meeting the sciences of the it all, yeah, save it all.
That's an archival perspective too.
Yeah.
Save it all. But we're, you know, over time we lose things. We do. It's inevitable.
We have limited resources, so we can't save everything.
Right, and so, you know, yeah. There's a point where your project is going to become the child of someone else, and it's going to have to be carried forward by someone else, or let go, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, and I think too, I think it's really important that you, you know, work with the BNF, let them know what you have, that you have created this wonderfully clean data set, a text file, that you know, that they might want to collect and preserve just that. Or they might want to say, hey, I'd really like to collect your entire project as a scholarly work. And in that case, you know, you have to find, again, someone who's interested in the work so you ensure that it goes forward. You know, I've seen too many scholars who are doing really amazing work that's related to collection in a different repository, and then their repository doesn't really care about it because it's not in their collecting area. And they just kind of go, why don't you ask them? You know, so you can, you know, try and get somebody who's really interested in what you're doing, who would want to continue to have it be accessible, and they can help you preserve it.
BNF.
Yeah. I think there's also what you're saying when you think of thinking about different pieces of what you're doing, that and Carol's comments earlier about like the different sorts of things that could be written about in your process, because I like a lot of these projects are constantly waiting for the kind of end point where it all works, it's ready, it's done, we can have the kind of final analysis, and some of them don't make it to that final stage, or things go wrong, things don't work. And so thinking about too, like, that documentation of the process of the struggle to get to the end point and writing maybe shorter papers or borrowing from other fields, like in the medical sciences where they write technical papers on, hey, I tried this new technique, I hasn't really been fully verified, but it worked in this one case where I was doing a bypass. Maybe this would help you. Like, I think too, rethinking our publication regime around what we're producing in these projects so that in the event that the project becomes abandoned or doesn't make it to that final stage, and there's someone I'm thinking